Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two guests today. We'll hear first from Forrest Hilton on protests and crackdown in Colombia. And then Jules Gill Peterson will talk about the political thinking underlying the spate of anti-trans bills proliferating through Republican-dominated state legislatures. Today's show is filled with material, so not much time for me to yak. My first guest is a Behind the News regular, Forrest Hilton, who teaches history and politics at the National University of Colombia in Medellin. He also writes frequently about that country and Brazil for the London Review of Books. Here he is to talk about massive protests and the vicious crackdown that's greeted them in Colombia. Colombia has been under governance by the far right for a couple of decades, first under President Álvaro Uribe, then under his successor and protege Juan Manuel Santos, though Santos eventually turned on Uribe and negotiated a peace deal with the FARC, the Revolutionary Guerrilla Force, and then under yet another Uribe protege, Iván Duque. Colombians seem to have had enough of it. Here's Forrest Hilton with more. Over the last few weeks, Colombia has seen strikes, mass protests, and absolutely vicious crackdown by the government. What started it? What's keeping it going? And what's it all about?
Colombia had a general strike in 2019, and a large part of what triggered that strike, that was in November of 2019, and it continued into December to some degree, a lesser degree, in January of 2020. And there were mass protests slated for March of 2020. So the strike was essentially set to continue. And of course, the pandemic hit, and Colombia had one of the longest and most severe lockdowns of about 6 months, roughly. So the government said that in order to cover the budgetary shortfalls that had opened up as a result of government spending during the pandemic, that they needed to introduce this unbelievably regressive sales tax measure on cereals, on milk, sugar, coffee, like so basic staples, as well as utilities, water, electricity, gas, 19%. So these are price hikes that people could not afford before the pandemic. And Colombian unemployment right now is around 14%, and it's certainly gotten much worse in the course of the pandemic. 50 to 60% of economically active Colombians work in the informal sector, and a huge percentage of those who are employed are in really crappy service employment with terrible wages and benefits. So they were not in a position before the pandemic, much less at this point in the pandemic, to be able to afford that kind of tax hike. And we should mention that in terms of the pandemic right now, Bogota's healthcare system is collapsing. They're at 96 or 97% capacity right now. Medellin's is also collapsing. And, you know, last I checked, I think they were having around 500 deaths per day in the country, and I guess something like approaching 80,000 deaths overall, and the population's around 51 million. So COVID has been absolutely wreaking havoc with healthcare system, which I should mention is fully privatized in contrast to Brazil, which has a robust public health system. And if they didn't, they would be in much worse shape than they are. Colombia doesn't have that. And one of the regressive measures that the Colombian government wants to introduce now regards further healthcare reform, but tax reform, healthcare reform, pension reform, labor law reform, you know, all these neoliberal reforms, which would shift all of the costs of the present crisis onto the people who can least afford it.
You almost couldn't design a more perfectly regressive package than what you've just been describing in the midst of an economic and social and health crisis. What are the political sensibilities of this government that would do something like that?
This was essentially the question that came up in 2019 when they introduced regressive tax measures and gave all sorts of tax breaks and subsidies to the big mining and energy corporations. So the question of, okay, what is the political sensibility or mentality of this government? Ironclad far right is the best way to characterize them. So yesterday was, you know, to be the first meeting of the National Strike Committee with the Colombian government to discuss what's going on. And talks broke off almost immediately. And the representatives of the National Strike Committee said, you know, the government has completely inflexible postures. It's not willing to move a millimeter on any of the sort of accumulated demands or accords that it has refused to comply with. So, you know, essentially there's nothing to talk about so far. They won't even talk about demilitarizing the cities right now. After almost 2 weeks straight of mass mobilizations on a scale Colombia's never seen before, this goes way beyond the general strike of 2019, the government's still not willing to even begin any kind of serious negotiations with the National Strike Committee. So that gives you an idea of how deaf the government is to what's going on in the streets. They still are just treating it as a police problem. The police have proven incapable of containing the protests. So my understanding is there's something like 12,000 soldiers on the streets of Cali right now, which has been the epicenter of this round of protests and mobilization. So the attitude the government has remains an attitude of sheer repression as the answer to popular protest, and also the criminalization, stigmatization of protesters as vandals, as subversives, as terrorists, and so on and so forth. So it's difficult to imagine a package that would be more likely to trigger a popular uprising, and this essentially for the second time in 2 years. This government negotiated agreements with students, who are the most numerous of the groups that are out in the streets. The government negotiated accords with the students in 2019, coming off the 2018 strike, but then didn't comply with the accords that it had signed. And this is true of indigenous people who signed an accord with the government, the so-called rural strike or agrarian strike in 2013 and again in 2014. The government signed some agreements with these sectors. And of course, the peace process itself that the government signed in 2016 with what was then the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. So the government has signed all of these agreements with all these different groups and sectors and has complied with none of them. Not only this government, but previous governments. So there's a lot of accumulated demands, and people are trying to get some minimal degree of compliance with their demands, which is part of what explains the lack of programmatic unity and to some degree sort of fragmentation, because there are so many groups and so many movements which have signed essentially separate deals with the government, and none of these deals are being honored. So it's essentially an avalanche of protests. Like, there's like 18 principal points that the National Strike Committee wants to negotiate with the government, or 18 themes that encompass something like 105 negotiating points. It's easy to see how this could lead to rather dramatic dispersal, both of you know, negotiating. The government wants to negotiate separately with different sectors or with different regions so that they don't have to negotiate globally. And at the same time, the National Strike Committee does not necessarily represent all of the movements and sectors and people in the streets right now. So there's an issue of political representation of the social movements themselves, and the government is certainly betting on that. That's one reason why they don't want to negotiate, because they don't think that the negotiators from the popular side even have the capacity to call the protesters off. So they're still, the government is therefore still, or one reason why the government is still betting on a strategy of repression is that they recognize that there is no clear leadership that they could negotiate with.
I saw some speculation on Twitter that this was all spontaneous, these strikes and protests. You keep speaking of organization. So how organized is this? What the organizations look like? Who's involved?
So the trade union centrals, there's three of those, and you know, there's sort of a long history behind each of the trade union centrals, but they all called this strike as they did in 2019. And the teachers union is another really important union that called this strike as it called the strike in 2019. Essentially, the unions and unions that have been at the forefront of protest and mobilization for some time in Colombia. But the Colombian trade union movement is really weak and not very representative. The total number of unionized members of the workforce is like 5%, maybe less, somewhere between 4 and 5%, I guess. The unions can only get so many people out in the streets. Their numbers have been dramatically reduced by the kinds of neoliberal labor law reforms that have been introduced since the early 1990s, and especially the government and paramilitary terror that was unleashed against the trade union movement in Colombia. So even though the trade union movements have called this, and trade unionists have certainly turned out all over the country, the numbers that we're seeing certainly can't be explained in terms of, you know, all the trade unions being mobilized. This goes so far beyond trade union membership. Now, students also have various organizations. They have three principal organizations, and students, in part because of neoliberal education reform, which aims to commodify and massify higher education, students are now far more numerous in Colombia than they would have been 20 or 30 years ago. And also, a great many students come from very humble backgrounds. And even in the case where they have access to decent public education, they can barely afford the bus fare to go back and forth to campus. They have to work in the informal sector, even to attend a public university in many cases. So the economic straits of students are themselves pretty dramatic, and certainly an awful lot of student households would have been unable to afford the regressive 19% sales tax. But students and young people more generally, young people who either aspire to be students or will not be but wish that they could have been students, are out in the streets. So there's a generational component to it that in part explains, I think, the distance between rank and file and leadership to some degree. The leadership skews quite a bit older in the trade unions and speaks to different generational experiences, I would say, of class struggle as well. And the student movement, by definition, is pretty young. Now, student movements in Latin America have traditionally had tons of like leaders who are in their 30s and even like 40, who just sort of stay around forever doing student politics. But that's really not the case in this conjuncture. The young people leading the student organizations, they're still quite young themselves. They're not professional student radicals. So part of the difficulty is between younger and older people, younger people in the student movement and older people in the trade union movement. But even within the student movement itself, there's a lot of debate and discussion, as there was in 2019, how representative are the leaders of these different student organizations, and how much democratic control do the rank and file of the student movement have over their representatives. It's pretty wild. We can see distance between rank and file and leadership within almost any movement or union, but then we also have these other gaps between generations and even within young people, between those who are, let's say, manning the barricades. In Cali, certainly, there are barricades up all over the place, and young people are the ones who are manning them, and then the student representatives. So I guess we could say that there's a generalized crisis of political representation, and that certainly extends all the way up to presidential candidate and Senator Gustavo Petro, who got 42% of the vote in the 2018 elections, which is a historic first for a left candidate in Colombia. And he's certainly well poised as of right now for elections in 2022. He's the front runner. But, you know, he has remained to some degree a little bit detached and disconnected from this round of mobilization, while obviously supporting its overall demands. Yet there's a sense in which, as much as the ruling class has tried to blame this recent round of mobilization on Gustavo Petro, that's not really credible. As much as they try to blame him and discredit him, saying that, you know, this is all his fault, a lot of people within the movements feel that Gustavo Petro doesn't really represent them or what's going on now. And I think it's a pretty hard sell for the government at this point to say that, you know, somehow this is all the fault of Gustavo Petro. But I should add, you ask about, okay, what's the mentality of this government? It's sort of Cold War counterinsurgent conspiracy theories, that this is all being led by communists. This is being led by guerrillas. You know, Gustavo Petro is always alleged to be in league with subversive forces out there. Petro is a demobilized guerrilla. So he gave up on armed struggle in, I believe, 1990 or 1991. So obviously that's not where he's at politically, and has not been where he's at politically for the entirety of his career. But nevertheless, the script that the Colombian government follows is that protesters, Gustavo Petro, Venezuela, you know, whatever they can throw at the wall and hope that sticks as some kind of well-orchestrated communist conspiracy. So those who say that this is all spontaneous are absolutely amnesiac. They're not seeing the context of recent mobilization and protest in Colombia. They're also not seeing something that was brought to my attention by one of my students, which is that as a result of the pandemic, plenty of popular grassroots organizations have tried to work together in self-help sort of solidarity. I mean, people are in such desperate circumstances and straits that these organizations have looked for ways to collaborate in getting people food or masks or gel. So there has been, since the pandemic hit, some greater infrastructure built between and among organizations. This is what I'm told. So that might explain some of the extent of the protests, which is really, really remarkable.
I'm speaking with the historian Forrest Hilton. Is there a program or an agenda, or is this just an expression of disgust and rage?
I think it's much more the latter than the former. I mean, certainly getting rid of the regressive tax measure, getting rid of regressive health, pension, labor law, all these things that the government wants to push through, allegedly to balance its budget and in the name of closing a budget deficit, everybody is opposed to that. Beyond those kind of basic oppositions, there is not a clear sort of programmatic horizon. You know, as I look at these 18 different points that the National Strike Committee is hoping to negotiate with the government, each point has, you know, a number of subheadings, and in total they add up to something like, you know, over 100 points that they're hoping to negotiate with the government. So there's not really enough political organization or representation. As I said, there's a crisis of leadership and a crisis of representation, and therefore there really isn't a kind of clear programmatic horizon whatsoever. To some degree, maybe the clear programmatic horizon becomes the elections in 2022 and making sure that the far right doesn't win, or really that the center right doesn't win, because right now it's looking like Alvaro Uribe and the current president, Iván Duque, that the sort of far right current that they represent is really on its last gasp.
So Duque's term is up next year, right? And he can't run again. So how much hope are people putting in Gustavo Petro? Is he an important figure or just a repository of hopes?
So Petro has an important trajectory as an opposition senator. And, you know, historically, he, at considerable risk to himself, denounced Álvaro Uribe's ties to paramilitarism when Uribe was in his second term. And as mayor of Bogotá, you know, stood up to entrenched interests and is certainly somebody who can't be intimidated and won't back down, and has a fairly clear kind of social democratic horizon as a politician. But it's odd, right? He won 42% of the vote in 2018, and is poised probably to do better the next time around. And yet there is a great deal of skepticism about whether that's the way forward, or whether the social movement agenda and its demands can really be met simply by trying to get Petro elected. I mean, obviously, there's no question that negotiating any of these demands would be considerably easier with someone like Petro in power, because, you know, the police and the armed forces would not be unleashed against demonstrators to begin with. But there really isn't, as far as I can tell, or certainly not yet. I mean, there may be too much sort of smoke in the air still to say whether this turns out to favor Petro and augment his popularity ahead of the elections, or whether, you know, if this turns out badly, whether the government will somehow succeed in sort of blaming it on him in the minds of, you know, a lot of citizens. And part of the government strategy, in addition to just unbelievably brutal repression, is also disinformation on a pretty epic scale. So the effort to confuse people about what's going on, who's actually responsible for acts of vandalism and so forth, it's possible that the government will succeed in somehow using these protests and this insurrection, basically, to discredit Gustavo Petro. But it's just as likely that the sort of inflexibility of the hard right-wing strategy is going to blow up in their face and add to Petro's popularity.
How much room for maneuver would a reformist social democratic president have, or would the oligarchy make it impossible for him to operate?
I think that's, you know, the same question that Lula in Brazil, who's currently slated to win in 2022, would be facing. I think in both cases, Colombia and Brazil, what would be necessary would be something like a government of national reconstruction. And of course, that elusive phantom, the so-called national bourgeoisie, is really nowhere to be found in either case. And you know, there's an argument to be made that even in the more properly Keynesian period, that a lot of these so-called national bourgeois sectors were not particularly national. But certainly now, you know, that I think would be like looking for a needle in a haystack, essentially. So it's hard to imagine what some broad coalition of national reconstruction would look like without really much in the way of a national bourgeoisie to participate in it. But I essentially think that what would be called for in Colombia would be a government of national reconstruction, because after neoliberalism and kind of warfare, Colombian style, and then the protests and dramatic repression, in addition to really historically high unemployment and poverty rates, the odds are incredibly formidable should Petro actually come to power. And I suppose he would have a lot of horse trading to do to be able to get anything done at all. And of course, the first part of that would be dealing with the armed forces, the intelligence agencies, the police, and so forth, and trying to bring them to heel. So it's a pretty tall order, but there is considerable fear in ruling circles that Petro has a real chance in 2022, and yet this government's inflexibility and repression seems to me to be likely to rebound in Petro's favor, but I'm not a forecaster, and so I really can't say.
That was Forrest Hilton, a professor of history and politics at the National University of Colombia in Medellin. You can find a lot of his topical work on the London Review of Books website. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Handel's Chaconne, HWV 443, performed by Roberto Laregian. 18th century harpsichord music has been one of the things that sustained me during this pandemic. And now on to my second guest, Jules Gill Peterson, an associate professor of English and Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. She had an excellent piece recently in Jewish Currents, looking at the politics behind anti-trans legislation that's sweeping the country. Something like 100 bills have been introduced in half our states that would restrict the rights of trans people, mainly by restricting young people's access to medical care and by prohibiting trans kids from participating in school sports. But there's much more behind it. Jules Gill Peterson. We've seen an enormous spate of anti-trans legislation coming out of mostly Republican-dominated state legislatures. Before we talk about the why behind them, just give us some sense of the landscape. How many? What are their ambitions? What are they trying to do? Just in the strict legal sense before we talk about their underlying rationale.
Yeah, it's a huge wave. You know, anti-trans bills aren't necessarily a new thing overall, but we've seen close to, if not at this point, over 100 bills in over half the states. So they're bills that mostly started in Southern and Midwestern state legislators. They really proliferated to encompass most of the country at this point. And the bills are pretty tightly clustered in two areas. There's sort of two main types of them. Both involve young people, children and adolescents. But one major type targets children, trans children's participation in organized sport, primarily in K through 12, but in some cases, potentially at the college level as well. And then the other main type of bill is a type of bill that would be banning or in some cases criminalizing and the delivery of gender-affirming healthcare to broadly conceived children. Some of the bills have, for some reason, gone up to as high as age 19, but some of them are a little bit younger. So really two types of bills, sports bills and healthcare bills, and some states passing, like Arkansas, multiple versions of the same bill for reasons that are unclear, but most states have at least one or two bills pending or passed. So really kind of a large proliferation of bills, even if they're all relatively similar and pretty narrow in terms of their legal interest or focus.
One that was introduced, I guess it was withdrawn, but introduced, but also quite revealing to the thinking underlying some of this, the North Dakota bill, HB 1476, which, as you quote, its aim was to prohibit the state from creating or enforcing policies that directly or symbolically respect non-secular, self-asserted, sex-based identity narratives or sexual orientation or orthodoxy. But then they also claim that transness is some kind of religion or a secular religion. Yeah, talk about the rationale behind this particular bill.
Yeah, this bill is really interesting, and I've written about it in part because what's unusual about it is very revealing. It's not typical of the other bills. The other bills don't go to such great lengths to derive a legal sort of framework for discrimination. And so what the North Dakota bill does very strangely is it names LGBT people broadly conceived, but it's specifically thinking of trans people, as adherence to a faith-based kind of dogma, a sort of pseudo-religion. And of course, they take great pains to say not all religions are formal, because of course, there's no religion of transgender. But they basically say that, you know, believing that you are trans or that you could transition or that also that people who believe in gay marriage and a whole bunch of things are essentially have to believe that only on faith. And so the state, you know, because of the First Amendment in the federal constitution, can't support the establishment of any faith-based structures. So therefore, the state of North Dakota must not only withdraw all legal and economic support of LGBT people, but it is legally required to discriminate to the maximum and basically disqualify trans people in particular, but also gay and lesbian people from any participation in public life. It's not a very good legal argument, of course, and that's probably why the bill was withdrawn. But what strikes me about this bill, you know, it'd be easy to dismiss it as absurd. I mean, you quoted from the bill, its language is so Byzantine, it's almost impossible to to get it out of your mouth, right, when you're reading it. But what the bill really shows us is there's more at stake here, right, than just some sort of culture war. Oh, you know, trans people are the hot topic for the right now. And so it could have been any number of other issues. It just happens to be trans people. And so, you know, we just have to mobilize to defeat these bills and, you know, we'll move on to the next battle. But what we see in that North Dakota bill that I think is really illuminating of the other bills around the country is that taking away trans people, trans children's healthcare, preventing them from participating in public life, which is what these bills do, is more than just a matter of discrimination. It's also about removing the possibilities for participation in democratic life. So it's about reorganizing the definition of citizenship basically implicitly in order to make the state proclaim itself, in other words, to be a kind of cisgender state. So North Dakota wanted to declare that the state has a gender and it's a cisgender. It's not a transgender, and no trans people are therefore allowed to qualify, you know, to participate in public life in North Dakota. And that really represents, you know, quite a particularly egregious danger to democratic norms. Obviously, anytime the state tries to decide that it has, say, an official sexuality or race or gender, we can easily look to American history to see the results of that. So there's actually a lot more at stake here. And I think that that North Dakota bill, as bizarre, I mean, it's clever, but it's, you know, it wasn't effective. It obviously never got passed. It didn't even make it to a committee in the North Dakota House. So it wasn't very effective. But I think it, in a way, it was sort of the anti-trans lobby showing its hand, really giving us insight into the larger political strategy at hand, which is about sort of installing evangelical Christian ethnostate. We've already seen that kind of politics attached to the fight against same-sex marriage in the mid to late 2000s. So it's not a new thing. It's sort of part of kind of larger culture warrior, right-wing evangelical fundamentalist political project. But for whatever reason, people have not paid a ton of attention to that this year. And so there really is this sort of embedded threat to democratic norms, I think, that's hiding out in this new wave of legislation.
Yeah, this reminds me of Oregon, what, a century or so ago, declaring itself an all-white state.
Right.
It's the same kind of thinking. Do we know who's behind these bills? Is there some kind of organized Koch-funded force that's writing these bills, or are they just sort of spontaneously sprouting up all over the place?
We do know, yeah, thanks to investigative journalism. And in this case, it seems to be, and there's some truth to the sort of shallow reading that this kind of intensification of anti-trans attack is to some extent a sort of callous political play. It's a 2022 midterm play. It's about an appeal to the post-Trump GOP base, one that is more openly courting right-wing extremism, conspiracy theories like QAnon, which have become very preoccupied with trans people. And so there is a sort of shallow play here. The groundwork for them has been laid for several years. You know, in 2016, we saw North Carolina passed that infamous bathroom bill, which sort of kicked off the wave of anti-trans legislating that we've been dealing with for the last 5 years. And so state legislators have served as laboratories to really test run these bills before this year. So Idaho and South Dakota actually were the two states that kind of tried to work on bills that became the real prototypes. And several of those were either defeated or are tied up in court. But this year, it looks like a number of organizations, conservative think tanks, some of which are considered or have been named by activists as hate speech groups, like the Alliance Defending Freedom, for example, have actually drawn up the templates for the bill. So a lot of the bills are, in fact, quite similar, share up to 20 or 30% of the same language, and essentially aim to do the same thing. So you've got these groups like that Alliance, also the Heritage Foundation and the Family Research Council, providing not just templates for the bills, but the talking points. They hold seminars where, you know, state legislators will show up and receive sort of training on how to think about this issue, what the talking points are. And then these organizations will show up to testify. In Arkansas, which was the first state to pass a ban on pediatric trans healthcare, which was vetoed by the governor, but then overturned. What was really interesting watching the hearings for that bill is you had the Family Research Council folks showing up there, and they were given lots of time. They were able to talk essentially for as long as they wanted in front of the committee. And then later a father of a trans child from Arkansas showed up to talk. And because he went 30 seconds over his time, whereas the conservative groups had gone way over their time, but this father went 30 seconds over his allotted time, and he was actually arrested and held in contempt of the Arkansas House. So just to show the lopsidedness and the sort of corruption embedded in this legislative process, you have the sort of charmed inner circle of these groups that essentially wrote the bills, show up. The state legislative assembly member who introduced the bill in Arkansas and was its primary sponsor didn't even really speak at the committee hearing. She made some bizarre remarks at the beginning about female genital mutilation, which has nothing to do with this issue. And then she turned over her time to these representatives from the Family Research Council, who took up as much time as they wanted. So there's really, actually, it's not just an insider kind of situation. And every time journalists have asked the individual legislators in different states to explain, hey, is there a big problem with trans youth, say, playing in high school sports in your state? Is that what prompted this bill? You know, a lot of them will openly admit, no, it's not a problem at all. I've never heard of any issue. Or the governor of West Virginia admitted in an interview not too long ago that he didn't really think this was actually a priority. But, you know.
Yeah, this is actually interesting because this is one of those things. There's something, I guess some people find this superficially reasonable. It's just unfair, you know, you have men competing in women's sports, you know, that kind of thing. But there's actually no demonstrable instance of this actually happening, is there?
That's right. An important thing to understand here for context is that we're living in a moment where most Americans are getting to know trans people for the first time. We're living in a moment of unprecedented cultural visibility, right? So you can turn on the TV, you can see on your favorite streaming platform or online on social media, lots of portrayals and representations of trans people, including trans young people, including teenagers, right? And so for the first time, a lot of folks who don't know trans people personally are encountering them, coming to imagine that they share the world with them. But in that moment, there's obviously an education gap. There's a relative lack of knowledge that people bring when you turn to Netflix or the internet, social media for information about trans people. You're not going to get a lot of it. And so I think what's actually happening is the anti-trans lobby is taking advantage of that relative lack of knowledge. And what they've essentially done is define these issues in advance through a series of fantasies, things that actually have no basis in reality, but they essentially create these straw man scenarios or hypothetical scenarios that sound really compelling, right? Men playing in women's sports. Well, that's not actually something that happens or would happen under these policies, or would be happening in the situations that these bills tried to regulate, or some of the actual bills will create scenarios that don't exist and then ban them. For example, young children receiving hormone therapies or surgery. That would never happen. There's no reason for that to ever happen. So a lot of the issue is actually based on a series of, it's helpful to think of it as a moral panic, right? So these bills provide sensationalized language around children, and they often imagine really graphic sexual scenarios or medical scenarios, and then, you know, cast it as reasonable to object to that. And of course, it would be reasonable if any of those things were true, but unfortunately, none of them are true. And they're often very cruelly almost the opposite of reality, right? So these bills will say, we're here to protect women and girls. And how will the bill protect women and girls? By endangering transgender girls, right? So there's no form of protection actually involved. There's it would be ironic, except it's so cruel. So I do think it's important for folks who are maybe getting to know this issue for the first time and are hearing a lot of the really paranoid and conspiracy theory driven, really extremist language that comes especially online, to know that a lot of it is quite literally made up, or at its best, it's sort of based in disingenuous bad faith, misinterpretations, and actually disinformation. This is very much the sort of post-Trump, post-fake news situation where we're seeing a series of misrepresentations, disinformation, outright lies being presented as fact in order to justify these really barbaric and quite cruel expansions of a police state to punish and regulate trans people.
I'm speaking with the trans studies scholar, Jules Gill Peterson. It's interesting how the story changes. Like you mentioned, a couple of years ago, it was bathroom bills. Now they're changing it to the sports and the mutilation and the hormones. It seemed like the bathroom argument never really took off. Most people really didn't care very much about it. So now they're moving on to what, more sensational material?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think of it, right? It's sort of a whack-a-mole situation. If your political position is made in bad faith and isn't based in reality, you can simply make up new stories. And so, you know, trans people have been subject to a lot of the kinds of moral panics that used to be applied to lesbian and gay people. So child predator panics, which is what the bathroom bills were about, ostensibly. And we're seeing similar language sort of applied to healthcare now. There's the bill in Texas that I believe was passed by one chamber in the legislature, which actually declares affirming the gender of a trans child to equal child abuse. And so the consequence of that is that the state of Texas would have the right to take trans children out of their homes and place them in foster care, where presumably they could be adopted by a family that would be invested in eradicating their transness.
That really doesn't sound like the best interest of the child are being taken care of.
It certainly doesn't now, does it? Yeah. But I think what we're seeing is just sort of an attempt to find anything. You know, it's easier to turn to fears about medicine, right? Because people generally don't understand what trans medicine is. And there are all sorts of lies that are told routinely online, especially by groups that have formed just primarily to spread disinformation or to engage in targeted harassment campaigns. It's somewhat similar to anti-abortion politics. So we've seen, you know, people making maps of gender affirming clinics, showing up to protest outside them, trying to heckle people who are going in for healthcare. Planned Parenthood does provide a great deal of gender affirming care to a lot of people in this country. So it's sort of been folded into broader narratives. But that kind of shift that you pointed out, right? First, it was bathroom bills. Then it was adult healthcare. The Biden administration just restored several legal protections for trans people today in the healthcare arena that the Trump administration had taken away, right? But there's sort of this continuing sliding scale to try and find whoever is the next vulnerable target. And children are very vulnerable, right? I keep finding myself saying this. If a state senator is introducing a bill to make it impossible for you to go to school or go to the doctor and you're 14, you can't run for your state senate to try and replace that person. You can't even vote against them. Children don't have those kinds of political rights. They rely entirely on the goodwill of other adults to defend their interests and to protect them from harm. And so I think there actually is, unfortunately, a really kind of vicious tactical assumption on the part of this lobby that it's good political capital to go after trans kids, that it's actually legitimate politics and even good politics from their perspective to declare it open season on trans children in this country. And so I think that's why we've seen that shift. Trans activists have been sounding the alarm about this for years. And unfortunately, now we're starting to see those chickens come home to roost.
And to return to that North Dakota bill, they were targeting what they called a secular religion around transness, but there's an awful lot of Christian theocracy behind these bills. So what is the Christian theocrats' agenda in crafting these bills?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, again, folks might feel like this is quite reminiscent of the evangelical fight against same-sex marriage, but even earlier against just the legalization of homosexuality, which, you know, as we'll recall, it took a Supreme Court decision in 2004 to make gay sex legal federally in this country. We're not talking about ancient history here, but it's basically, you know, the sort of Christian theocratic agenda here, right, perceives any threat to the sort of white nuclear heterosexual family to be a kind of cataclysmic event that deserves the harshest possible punishments and prevention mechanisms. And so really what's sort of going on in the North Dakota bill is a good example here. It's very savvy, right? Because basically this whole business around this language of secularism, et cetera, feels like it makes no sense, right? Like, oh, well, if you're declaring trans people to be adherents to some sort of faith-based belief system, then how is it that the state is allowed to endorse Christian ideals? Because Christianity actually is a religion and there, you know, we have the First Amendment, right? But actually it's not so much a contradiction as it is a savvy exploitation of a vulnerability in the sort of legal framework of the Republic, which is that there are sort of universal, right? The Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, Constitution makes a series of universal declarations about what a citizen or a person of this country is. And so what these bills try to do, again, in sort of declaring that the state is cisgender, it's much like the way that the Defense of Marriage Act or the federal marriage amendment that was proposed during the second Bush presidency, right, tried to declare that the U.S. government was heterosexual, right? That was literally codified into the law in the case of DOMA, right? That the state had a state interest in promoting heterosexuality and therefore not only did not permit same-sex marriage, but therefore was justified in heavily discriminating against gay and lesbian people. The state had a legitimate interest in its mind in discouraging people from being gay and lesbian. And that's what opens the door to very dangerous politics of trying to eradicate gay and lesbian people from the face of the earth. And we're seeing the same thing now in terms of transness. So being transgender is, in this particular ideological worldview, understood to represent something like the collapse of a certain ideal of society or a certain power structure that keeps a certain kind of vision of the family or of gender or of sexuality in place. And so the state is sort of trying to use that same maneuver and declare itself as anti-trans in order to not just leave trans people without support, but to actively discourage their existence. And that does seem to come from this kind of fundamentalist worldview that sees anything outside of extreme, strict binary sex roles as a kind of sinful or degenerate situation, which, you know, maybe people sincerely held religious beliefs, right? That would be one thing if they were privately held, but it is obviously a different thing when we see the government trying to legislate from that basis and empower itself to actively attack and discourage people from existing if they are trans.
Well, it seems important to underscore the point, though, that to this worldview, the gender binary is really foundational. I mean, and anything that threatens that really threatens the foundations of civilization in their view, right? Which is why they take this stuff so very seriously. And there's a tendency among some people on the left, for example, to say, oh, you know, there are more important issues right now. But you know, really, this stuff is very foundational to a very significant portion of the American population.
That's right. You know, and it's like these bills are not symbolic. Let's look at what they do. They'll take away your ability to go to the doctor, right? So you're reducing your life chances, and not just go to the doctor, but if you're trans and you want to transition and you can't, I mean, that's a life and death situation for a lot of people. It's not hyperbole. A lot of folks who have testified against these bills, pediatricians, for example, have said, some of my patients will die if these bills are passed because I will no longer be allowed to support their gender identity and provide them with healthcare, right? Other set of bills make it impossible for you to participate in equal education, put a target on your back in school. Some of the bills, like in North Carolina, would legally require teachers to out any student who displayed quote unquote gender nonconforming behavior to their parents. That's not symbolic. That's a real material harm. And so what happens is these bills are trying to reduce the life chances of trans people. They are in the outcome hoping to discourage trans people from existing by trying to prevent their development as children, trying to prevent trans children from growing up to be trans. And that's a really disturbing kind of platform, I think, by any measure, but there's more at stake for everyone. Right. And I think here we have to look at what have state legislators with GOP supermajorities focused on this year. It's three issues primarily: these trans bills, voting rights restriction bills, and anti-abortion bills. Right. So Arkansas, a few days before it passed its ban on trans healthcare, had passed a really restrictive abortion ban. Right. And so basically, if the state governments, you know, in the wake of this COVID epidemic, where we've seen the unnecessary death of over 500,000 people, are creating new justifications for further withdrawing the state from providing for public health and public education, not just withdrawing, but banning the very possibility. This is going to have huge implications for democratic norms and also for things like women's reproductive health, right? Access to birth control and abortion all will follow very closely along with where trans healthcare goes, right? And we talk about equal education, and we're seeing continued, you know, attempts to install hierarchies and forms of segregation in schools, which is a huge issue. We're seeing also the restriction of voting rights of African Americans, right? So I think we're looking at a broader anti-democratic agenda, and it's quite authoritarian, right? For the state of Texas to be able to take children out of the home, or the state of North Carolina to be able to require teachers to out students, or for the state of Florida, in a bill that it passed, to open the door to genital inspections of young children at school. This is not the role that I think many people want to see the state governments taking. It's profoundly anti-democratic. It's a profound contravention of individual liberty, bodily autonomy. But I really think we have to see this as connected to broader struggles, not just for women's rights and for the rights of racial minorities, but more broadly, questions about healthcare justice in this country, right? Like, what kind of future are we going to have for caring for our population? And that's a question that's really on everyone's mind as we sit in year two of this pandemic. So you're right, there's a lot at stake here. It's not just an issue that affects a small minority of people, although it does affect trans people very harshly. And I think that should be enough to get anyone motivated. But there's also a broader picture, and I think people need to pay attention to that because there's a lot at stake. And I have been somewhat disappointed to see a lot of the pushback on these bills from Democrats and other sort of mainstream organizations not really seeing the big stakes here, because in my mind, we have an opportunity to understand different groups of people's interests as interrelated here, right? And so there's actually a reason why this is not a distraction for the left. This is actually goes to the center and the core of what progressives and leftists are fighting for in this country at this moment, where we see not just a rise in wealth inequality or the pursuit of all these forms of discrimination, but also a severe erosion of democratic norms and direct attacks on democracy. You know, you have someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Georgia representative who is under increasing fire for her implicit or explicit allegedly endorsements of the January 6th Capitol riot. She's also one of the most fervently anti-trans members of Congress, and she ties that directly to her support of QAnon, you know? So it's like, there's a lot going on here that people would be forgiven for not seeing all the connections, but just to sort of spell them out like that, actually trans issues and trans youth sit at the nexus of a lot of the broader stakes that we're facing right now for the future of democracy in this country.
And to recall the old labor slogan, an injury to one is an injury to all.
Exactly, right? Solidarity is actually a really good model here. One thing one way I often like to put that is actually really simple, right? Trans people might be under attack, but guess what? We all have a gender, and we all need forms of healthcare and respect for and recognition of our gender, whether we are trans or not. And so if there are these kinds of precedents being established coming after trans people, I mean, it's not going to stop there. And there's going to be a lot of these policies, for example, one of the biggest problems that they face and why they're impractical is you can't actually know who is trans and who is not just from looking at them, right? And so that bill in Florida that produces a policy solution by asking that children's genitals be inspected at school, like what a dangerous policy platform. That is not a safe thing to do. It's also not necessary, but it's not going to be restricted to trans kids. Neither is that bill in North Carolina where teachers will have to out any child who doesn't display stereotypical gendered behaviors. I mean, that's going to hit all kinds of kids, right? And so there really is a lot of danger, I think, attached to legitimizing this discrimination against one group because it will have effects on everyone.
That was Jules Gill Peterson, who teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. Her book, Histories of the Transgender Child, was published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2018. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of Beethoven's Serenade for String Trio, Opus 8, the fourth movement, performed by the Grumio Trio. Till next week, bye.